It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast for September 9th, 2022. My name is Tom Luongo and we have a lot to talk about. It is episode 117, and I know it's been a while since episode 116, but, you know, hey, life gets in the way. This morning I'm going to go off the beaten path of my normal set of guests and whatnot. It's a man who was referred to me by a longtime listener who thought I should have a broaden my perspective and talk about Switzerland. His name is Pascal Nachati. He's a former investment banker who has covered Central Asia, Central Europe, Russia, Africa, the Middle East, and is based in Switzerland and has some very, very interesting and unique perspectives on what's going on with Swiss neutrality in Switzerland, and wanted to get him on the podcast this morning in order to, broaden my horizons as much as everybody else's. So good morning, Pascal. Thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
I was sent an article of yours and then about your fears about what's happening in Switzerland. Would we have the Swiss president has, for all intents and purposes, declared Switzerland effectively, and I wouldn't say a combatant, but Switzerland's taken sides in the current conflict in Ukraine and versus Russia and whatnot. And so I want you to kind of lay the background out for people, give us an idea of what's going on, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think we should go back to the history first.
Sure.
Switzerland is a confederation since 1291. Mm-hmm. We enjoy neutrality here since 1815. Those were the Paris Accords, which got confirmed by the Vienna Convention of the same year, 1815. So basically, Switzerland has neutrality since 1815. We went through a lot of trouble ourselves. We had Napoleon, as you can imagine. We had First World War, Second World War. We always remained neutral. We also remained neutral during U.S. and NATO instigated wars like, Vietnam, Korea, Iraq 1, Iraq 2, Libya, Yugoslavia. We remained neutral. We didn't impose any sanctions on anybody. We remained neutral. We were always a place to negotiate peace. Mm-hmm. But if you are not neutral in general, you cannot negotiate peace because you're not credible. And the problem we have now here today is, without taking any sides, this is to promote neutrality. I'm not trying to take any sides. This mm-hmm. is about Switzerland and Swiss neutrality. Mm-hmm. Switzerland is still one of the major financial centers in the world. Agreed. Switzerland is known to be small, humble, strong, rich, and has a fairly good defensive army. Nota bene, defensive army. We never, ever were part of any military union or any military grouping around us. We always remained neutral. Since the 24th of February, we have a major war going on in Europe. Russia has invaded Ukraine, and they call it the special military operation because Russia felt threatened, provoked by NATO's eastward expansion towards the Russian border. The Swiss president, Ignazio Cassis, when he became president earlier this year, he decided to take sides. So he and his fellow members of the council, some of them flew to Kiev with the Air Force plane of our president, showing support for Ukraine. There's nothing wrong by showing support to another country, but doing a photo op with the Swiss Air Force aircraft in Ukrainian territory is the wrong move to do if you want to be neutral. Then there was a Lugano conference in summer organized by Zelensky, President Zelensky of Ukraine, and our Swiss President Cassis. Was called the Reconstruction Conference for Ukraine. It was attended by 1,000 people, by several heads of states, ministers from Europe, and the goal was to promote the reconstruction of Ukraine. Now, clearly, Ukraine needs to have help to rebuild the country at some point. But it's not for Switzerland to decide who is winning or losing the war. You see, if you promote neutrality, you cannot promote a dominance one over the other. In this case, Cassis makes the assumption that Russia is losing and Ukraine is winning. It's a capital mistake. It's a blunder. Taking sides is never allowed if you want to be neutral. And we have a unique chance. We have been a platform for peace negotiations of many, many conflicts of warring parties in the past. The neutrality is a strong tool to promote peace. In other words, if you have a functioning neutrality, then a credible neutrality to all sides, then you have trust, trust from both parties. And that trust gives you the power to call for peace negotiations. Right now, as it stands, right now, this is not the case. Last month, President Cassis made another blunder. He's not very good in foreign relations because he's not a diplomat. He's a medical doctor. I respect him for that. I respect all medical doctors because they fix people and they swear on their oath that they will always help people. But now he is president. He's not very experienced in diplomacy. He promised President Zelensky a month ago that Switzerland will be the protecting nation in Russia, which means that Switzerland, the Swiss embassy, would handle all consular business of Ukraine in Russia. He promised that. The problem is he first should have consulted the Russian Federation. Because every government has a protocol. You cannot do neutral jobs in a foreign country if you are a foreign agent of another country. It's impossible. So he promised first, then he went to Russia. I mean, they communicated with Moscow, and the Russians said, I'm very sorry, we would like you to do that, but you cannot because you're not neutral. It was a total loss of face. It just is not credible to act like this. This is happening here in Switzerland now, where we should remain neutral and take a position to foster peace with our neutrality. And this is a bit of a problem. It's hotly discussed here in Switzerland because we have imposed, or we took over, the EU sanctions against Russia. Again, we should not impose sanctions against Russia. We should accept neither country sanctions on either party.
I would agree with that. Sanctions are acts of war. So, and I mean, in basic moral terms, I've always, you know, politically, just so you know, I don't know, we only just met, you know, today, and we had a short talk earlier in the week, but I'm politically, I'm a radical libertarian. Like, as far as I'm concerned, Yes. Sanctions are an act of war, and Switzerland putting sanctions on people is a fundamental break of neutrality.
It is a fundamental break of neutrality, and the other point is we are shooting ourselves in the foot again. Look, we are a rich country, there's no doubt. We have the highest per capita income, I guess. We are a small country. Just for the audience, we are only 41,000 square kilometers of size.
Right.
Give you an example. Switzerland fits 414 times into Russia.
Right.
let that sink in. All right. So from the geographic position, we are Europeans. From the culture, we are Europeans.
Of course.
We're not European Union, of course, but we are Europeans. Now, if you look at our situation on the energy side, we took up to now 25% of our gas from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That's energy we need for heating, for energy production.
Mm-hmm.
Imposing sanctions on Russia made us the following: unreliable, not neutral.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians call us an unreliable country.
Yep.
The Russians label us now to have an unreliable currency.
Mm-hmm.
And they label us an enemy of Russia.
Yep.
So go back to 1815. Since 1815, we have been peaceful and we had neutrality. And now we made Russia to our enemy. It's right. Unheard of. It's unheard of.
Wow.
So it goes further. Now our president wants to align himself or us with NATO. This is another breach of neutrality. Even the thought of it is wrong. His party, his political party, which is a centric party, they call themselves liberals, but they're not. They have been destroying the economy for the last 20 years by sheer incompetence.
Right.
They are making a study now to see whether or not we should send soldiers, Swiss soldiers, to Ukraine alongside NATO. Switzerland. What do we have to do there? It's not our war.
But it sounds like President Cassis is. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
It sounds like he's a neoliberal, not a liberal. It sounds like that he's a. You know, it sounds more globalist than it sounds.
He's a globalist. He is a globalist. Absolutely. And you see, he was born Italian. He was raised Italian. Only in 2017 he gave away his Italian citizenship because he had to go into our government. So his patriotism for our country is not the same like mine. I have an ancestor who was president of this country.
Right.
So again, I really want to bring that home. This war is terrible.
Yes.
War is always terrible. Nobody wants war.
Of course.
But we have many more tools, and the strongest one was or is neutrality if we then have it. So
right.
Here is the plan for him. I would suggest, and I'm curious to see if there's any reaction from the audience about this. I say, first, we have to completely renounce any alliance with NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we have to withdraw all our sanctions, which we took over from the EU against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Third, we should make sure that there are no Swiss weapons and Swiss munitions used in Ukraine against Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah, a minimum
to do. We should adhere to our neutrality, resume the neutrality, call for peace, and preferably involve both principles, the US and the Russian Federation.
Agreed.
Because this war is a proxy war between the US and the Russian Federation. Every child will realize that after 6 months.
Well, I would put the finer point on it. It's also I think there's the British are very much involved in this as well.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
And there is a distinct the way I've been looking at geopolitics recently, Pascal, is a beginning to realize that the British are under a kind of feeling of an they're being pulled in two directions between Europe and the EU's desire to undermine Brexit and their relationship with their potential independence by aligning with the U.S. But you have a Biden administration that effectively works for the European Union. And you have, I think, sovereigntist forces within the U.S. banking industry, the commercial banking industry, and the Federal Reserve are working to undermine that. And so this is a very, very interesting tug of war in both directions. And yes. So you have old British. And so in the process of this, what you have in both the U.S. and the U.K. in this kind of power vacuum and struggle are, you know, old anti-Russians in both circles fomenting a conflict against the Russians, because it's been British. It's been a focal point of British foreign policy for 150 years to destroy the Russians. Yes. It's been a focal point of American foreign policy, thanks to British infiltration of our foreign policy establishment for the last 70 years to help them achieve that goal. And, you know, Swiss neutrality is now being sacrificed on the altar of trying to save the European Union. And that's the European correct. Union is, and I think the European Union is happy to go along with this war, but they want to play the victim and virtue signal that it's all the Americans and the Brits' problem. When the truth of the matter is that they sanctioned this war, with this proxy war between the United States and the US/UK, all the way down the line, up until the moment where it starts to, where Putin started to pull the energy card against them. That's how I
So. They pulled 8,000 sanctions on Russia.
Yeah, I know.
8,000 sanctions. The energy sanctions, again, homemade stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take Germany. Germany, the German growth engine of the economy, depends on cheap Russian energy.
Absolutely.
They laid two pipelines, Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, to accomplish that goal. And the Germans sanctioned Nord Stream 2. They themselves don't know how to heat the homes. You have to understand, 50% of German homes, and these are tens of millions,
I know,
they are depending to heat their homes with Russian gas. Yep. There will be no gas. Now, towards these so-called Putin pulling the energy card, let's look at the technical aspects of it.
Sure.
I believe he wanted, or the Kremlin wants, to be seen as a reliable supplier. That's their goal. But those people forget the pipeline has a lot of pumping stations and needs energy, and that energy is produced through turbines, mm-hmm. their gas turbines, and they need maintenance. But the sanctions imposed by also Canada, some of the turbines come from Canada,
mm-hmm.
and Germany, they forbid to sell or to transfer turbines, spare parts, or the likes to Russia. So Russia is saying, we are handcuffed and you ask us to swim, we can't. Right. Therefore, we stop the pipeline transfer. Otherwise, this thing's going to blow up and right. it's going to blow around our faces.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality. It was not Putin threatening, saying, you know, if you don't do that, I will pull the gas or stuff like that. Right. It is just a matter of reality, and the Germans, they don't want to admit that.
Mm-hmm.
They went into the wrong direction, completely mm-hmm. wrong. Yep. The only solution to this war is a diplomatic solution, a peace negotiation.
I agree.
We have never been so close to a nuclear war. The Cuba crisis looks like a kindergarten compared to what's going on right now.
I know. And I wrote a piece the other day about Liz Truss taking over as the British prime minister. And she's horrific, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, they're trying to make her into the second coming of Maggie Thatcher. She's willing to, you know, use nuclear weapons. You know, she's the horrible combination of ambitious, stupid, and intractable.
Yeah, I can describe her a bit differently. she's a narcissist,
mm-hmm.
highly incompetent,
mm-hmm.
and highly aggressive.
Yes.
If you combine those things, the narcissism is a very important point.
Yes.
For psychology, then you know what she said in her election campaign. She said she will use nuclear weapons against Russia.
Yep.
She's prepared to. I mean, she's capable of frying England with one pop.
Yep.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Nuclear weapons here are a deterrent.
Yes.
On all sides, they are used as a deterrent.
Yes.
When you talk about nuclear weapons, you have to really, in my view, put every word and comma on a scale before you say it.
Agreed.
Because the consequences of it, as we know, will be devastating.
Agreed. And since the beginning of the war, both the Brits and the Russians have been treating each other and their and nuclear brinksmanship with a kind of rhetorical casualness, casualness that is disturbing. And, you know, I understand I hate to say a soft spot, but I have sympathy for the Russian point of view in this entire thing. And I get why people like Dmitry Medvedev would give back to the Brits rhetorically what the Brits have been giving back to them, but over using nuclear, but talking about, you know, wiping out Britain with one tidal wave from a nuclear weapon under an underwater nuclear weapon is still an intensely sanely provocative statement. It really does undermine Russia's credibility. You know, as a diplomatic agent, you know, it's like, look, you know, the Brits are terrible. Don't rise to the bait. Don't take the bait. You know, one of the things that I've lauded the Russians about over the years is how Sergei Lavrov has made everybody his friend.
Right. He's the best diplomat there is in the world right now.
Absolutely. By an order of magnitude. And so when Medvedev says things like that, it really does undermine Lavrov's,
It undermines that is true, and it's not, it's not intelligent to do so. The rhetoric is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I can give you maybe an example why this is. Medvedev is positioning himself as the aggressive Russian here.
Sure.
Putin is not speaking like that.
No.
Lavrov is not speaking like that, talking like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the bad cop and the good cop.
Sure.
What you have to focus on is what Putin and Lavrov say.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
The problem is, though, again, because it's the ex-president Medvedev talking like this, it's not helpful for the process.
Agreed.
And it escalates. Then one rhetoric escalates the other one. And, you know... the Brits are also, I mean, Liz Truss, you mentioned her before. We talk about Liz Truss. It's a horrible combination, and she will have to deal with a lot of problems domestically first. Look at the landscape. I am for all the women to be in power. I'm not anti-woman. I think women should be in politics, in companies, in our lives. They are already, we love them. But the combination we have on the globe right now is disturbing. We have... I call her Chef Word Salad Harris in America.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We've got now Liz Truss.
Yep.
And we've got my special friend Ursula von der Leyen from the European Commission.
Yeah.
Ursula is the same phenomenon.
Yeah.
A narcissist, hugely incompetent.
Yep.
And hugely aggressive.
Yeah. They're all cut from the Hillary Clinton model.
And then you have Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister of
Germany.
She made some extremely threatening statements as a foreign minister, which are damaging to Germany and Europe.
Agreed.
She should not be in that position. She has never worked in an office. She's never worked in a diplomatic office. She never held a responsible job in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She changed the accession rules to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Germany so that she can employ people from her circles that do not qualify for the job. I mean, think about that.
Oh, I know.
This is Germany. From the 1st of October, there will be German military patrolling the streets in Germany.
Yes.
Have we not seen that before? Yes. 70 years ago?
I know.
I mean, I thought we have stopped all this nonsense, but it's coming back.
It is coming back. I was on a show with Alexander Mercurius, the Duran, the other day, and I was just very blunt with him. I said, look, the Germans are reverting to type. I hate to say this. And, you know, that may sound racist and it might sound terrible, but it's like, look, it is what it is. When people are under stress, when they're under a kind of, they feel like they're under an existential threat, they revert to their imprinting and they revert to their cultural norms. And that's this, and we're seeing that all across Europe. And this is why the European Union is not a force for cohesion, but a force for division. And yes, the people who are pushing, and it's the World Economic Forum and the people who stand behind them and whatnot, their idea of, you know, I read a thing about Klaus Schwab the other day where somebody said, look, Klaus isn't the Nazi. Klaus is actually the hyper anti-Nazi, which is he's trying to impose, for lack of a better term, technocratic communism on and the end of nationalism across all of Europe as a unification strategy. And what he's going to wind up with is the fracturing of Europe back into smaller tribes, because one of the things that happens when you're not, when things are tough, tribes get smaller.
Yes.
Right. We revert to our families. We revert to our, yes, our, and because of that, Europe is not going to become one big tribe. It's going to devolve back into 35 different tribes or however many there are.
Yes,
and the end of Swiss neutrality is clearly an attempt to bring Switzerland into this monstrous thing that, yes, is the European Union.
That's the big danger, and it's a danger to peace. You know, Tassis or Switzerland as a government did not reject neutrality, still there with the Den Haag contracts. But again, taking sides with one nation over the other is clearly a breach of neutrality. It just doesn't go. Imposing sanctions on one over the other is a breach of neutrality.
Agreed.
So every living human being with a right mind will judge us and will say, look, we like Switzerland, but they're not neutral anymore. Okay. It has big implications for banking and finance as well.
Agreed.
Guess where the money now is flowing to? It's going to Singapore.
Yep.
The Singaporeans have managed to get along with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing a better job right now.
That's a really, really good point. Thank you. I hadn't really thought about that because, I mean, again, I'm glad we had this chat this morning because Switzerland and Zurich were off. You know, I mean, I understand kind of the dynamics with City of London and Frankfurt and New York and, you know, Hong Kong to a lesser extent. But I've always known that Singapore is the gateway for China's mechanism, potential for China to ascend as the destination for global capital on the other side of this period in history. But I've always understood that. But listening to you say that the money is now flowing out of, it's not going to flow through Zurich anymore, it's going to flow through Singapore, which of course other people have mentioned in the past is the Zurich of Southeast Asia.
Yes.
You know, like sometimes it's like all the pieces are there in your head, but they don't crystallize. They don't coalesce until somebody says something as simple as what you just said. So I think it's a very important point.
Thank you. Singapore is not just the Zurich of Southeast Asia. Singapore is the Zurich of all of Asia.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's hugely important in the region, and it's super small.
Mm-hmm.
What are they? They're humble. They're strong. They're very strong, and they have a defense military. They don't have an offensive army.
Right.
They're not aligned with NATO. They're not aligned with anybody else. They believe in themselves, with self-confidence, like we do as well.
Mm-hmm.
When my great-granduncle was president of this country, it was during the Second World War. We were surrounded by the Germans, by the Nazis. At that time, our military was worth nothing. It was just, believe me, it was a horse and a few cannons, I mean, to put it into a perspective.
Right.
We had no money. We had no real we don't have resources. We had, at that time, banking was not developed. We were a poor country. So my great-grand-uncle went to the border to negotiate with Mr. Hitler. And he was a blunt guy. My great-granduncle was a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And he always spoke in a way bluntly to people so they could understand him better. He didn't speak to them academically. And they felt that he's in touch with the people. So he asked Mr. Hitler, he said, what do you want from us? We have no resources. We have no money. We don't have anything for you to take. except a small piece of land that is full of rocks. And Hitler said, I want to put the train from north to south, the weapons from north to south through Switzerland to Mussolini. And my great uncle said, is that what you want? He was a realpolitik man. He said, is that what you want, to spare bloodshed? We'll do it. It's fine.
Right.
We had to. We had the gun at the head.
Sure.
So if you're in a dark alley at 3 a.m. and somebody puts a gun on your head, you will tell him what you want. He says, the wallet. Say, here, take it.
Yeah, please. Absolutely.
You know, I'm not going to die for this.
Yeah. There's 50 bucks in there. You know, it's all you know.
Yes. We took a lot of Jewish refugees. A lot of them settled in Switzerland, opened even banks here. We have the largest private bank is Jewish, who benefited from that time because of all the Jewish migration into Switzerland. So we were neutral. We remained neutral in this period. Now we have this go back to Ukraine and Russia. Here we are not neutral anymore. We have to go back to our neutrality, and we have to make sure that we don't, as you mentioned correctly, slip into this European EU swamp where we don't belong. People don't want to see us with NATO. People don't want to see us with the European Union, for God's sake, not. And the European right now, as you rightly concluded, is falling apart. Mm-hmm. You have the Hungarians who are smart. The Hungarians made two statements, three statements. They said it's not our war. They said no weapons will go from our country to Ukraine. And they said no gas will go to other countries because it belongs to the Hungarian taxpayers.
That's right. Yep. Oh, FYI, I don't know if you saw this the other day, but Hungary is an area of Europe I've studied, you know, quite explicitly. And because I've always understood that they're the potential for leading all of European, the Eastern, all of Eastern Europe out of the EU in the end, right?
Yes.
Viktor Orban is a tremendous leader. And I saw the other day that Rosatom just announced that they're building two nuclear power plants in Hungary. And so their energy independence is going to go forward. They will never take on the euro. They will always use, as long as Viktor Orban is in power, they will have the forint.
Yeah.
If anybody should take a page out of Hungary's book, it's Poland. But the Poles won't, because the Poles hate Russians almost as much as Brits do. And maybe with good reason, maybe not. It's irrelevant at this point. What we're, you know, at some point, you know, the reality is that you're better off being, you know, you're better off not being belligerent and sitting down and talking to people. And I've been arguing for 2 years now that an undersecretary of the Polish foreign minister and an undersecretary of Sergei Lavrov should get together and have coffee somewhere in a neutral third party place in Budapest and just sit down and start working on a framework for Polish-Russian, you know, relations where the Poles can get gas from the Russians or whatever, and just stop the nonsense.
Yes. And this is, of course, indoctrination from the states. The Polish have been indoctrinated because they are geopolitically important. If you look at the map. Mm-hmm. But go back to the Hungarians. They are very smart people. I financed Hungary as a banker for many years in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I've been there many, many, many times. I financed the central bank with our bank. I didn't do that from my own pocket, of course. We're talking billions of Swiss francs. The Hungarian history is very important to recognize. They are not Slavs.
Right.
The Hungarians are Mongols mixed with Finnish tribes.
Mm-hmm.
The Mongols had an argument near Kazakhstan. They were one tribe. They had an argument. They separated each other. One went east. They ended up in South Korea. Mm-hmm. That's where they ended up. The other tribe went west, and they ended up in Budapest. Those were the so-called seven heroes. If you go to Budapest, there's a square with the seven heroes on the horses.
Right.
That was 1,000 years ago. They mingled with the Finnish. So the language, the Hungarian language, is a mix. It sounds very much Finnish. It's a difficult language to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hungarians are extremely smart people.
These are things I did not know. And this is fascinating. Budapest is definitely a city on my list to go visit. And I have friends in Hungary that are desperate for me to go and visit them over there. And hopefully at some point in the future, my schedule will allow for that to happen. So,
Will love it. But go back to the Ukraine conflict and Switzerland and the neutrality. This is the ultimate time now for us to stand up. We are the Swiss citizens. We are the sovereign. The sovereign of Switzerland is the people. We have a direct democracy.
Right.
Normally in our country, we have seven councillors. Seven. Right. Always seven. And they consult each other in a room about any situation, economic, socioeconomic, military, security. We never had a president. Well, then every 4 years you have an elected of the seven, one guy or one lady becomes the president. Mm-hmm. The president in our constitution is not like the US president. In fact, the Americans, America copied the Swiss constitution actually, but they put on top one executive power, the president.
Yes.
Cassis is behaving now like an American president.
Right.
He shouldn't do that because it's not in our tradition to behave like that. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the neutrality topic right now is discussed very hotly in this country and abroad because other nations are looking at us again and they're saying the Swiss are losing it. Yeah. They're completely losing. Now, if we do not correct that mistake, as you rightly said, we will be drawn into this thing and we'll go into this so-called washing machine of the EU and we'll be finished. We'll be completely finished.
I know. I can see it on the horizon. It's clear that that's the goal of everybody who is in power in Europe at this point, is that the goal is to export. It's to subsume as all of Europe, expand the European Union and make it the standard by which everybody else does trade around the world. It's very clear that I look at the European Union and I see the California model. Yeah, here in the United States, we say every bad idea that happens in the United States starts in California and travels east because California has such immense political power within the Congress that they can and economic power that they can then impose their will on the rest of the United States, even if the rest of the United States doesn't want it. Well, clearly that's the same model that the European Union is doing through its regulatory schemes and everything else. Well, going back to Liz Truss, for example, I was thinking about this. I was just writing about this before you and I sat down for this call. I was doing a post for my patrons. I was talking about the Queen dying and Liz Truss and trying to find a silver lining in Liz Truss as prime minister, because you should always try to look at things from both perspectives. One is that the Northern Ireland Protocol is the key to undermining Brexit and reversing Brexit. And if Truss's attitude towards that is going to make a big difference. And it's, again, it's just this. If you look at the way Brexit negotiations laid out, the EU left poison pills behind in order to still have regulatory control, even if there's a legal separation between the UK and the EU. And this is the way they operate on every level. And this is the way they think about every contract that they sign.
Yes,
so
it's a big problem. The UK is overregulated. You have to deregulate the UK to make it function. I lived there for 10 years. I worked there for 10 years in the 90s. The 90s were brilliant. But since then, the country is going downhill. And the only way for Britain to flourish again is to deregulate and, for God's sakes, not to have this aggressive rhetoric against other countries. It doesn't serve the purpose. I tell you a little thing, an anecdote. In 1998, I was invited to the House of Lords for a lunch. Mm-hmm. In the House of Lords, we had a private room. Lord Johnston at the time was the delegate of NATO for the eastward expansion of NATO in Central Europe. So the guest was Peter Schuster. Peter Schuster was the mayor of Košice, which is the second largest city of Slovakia, the Republic of Slovakia, small country. Mm-hmm. And he came there with his translator, his daughter, as the mayor and hopeful president. He was a candidate for presidency in the elections. And then Lord Johnson, at the dessert, he said, well, let's talk about NATO. And I was really surprised that we talked NATO about in this lunch, because it was not on the agenda. And he said, you should, when you become president, your country should join NATO. Then Peter said, quite astonished, he said, yeah, but what does it entail? What do we need to do to become NATO member? And he said, oh, don't worry, Pete. We'll send you a fax with all the questionnaires to fill in the blanks. What kind of hardware do you have? And then we will send you another fax with the recommendation what the hardware should be to be NATO compliant. I was shocked. And then I interjected and said, why don't we send the fax to Russia? Why don't we just, you know, what is NATO for? Why do we need it? We don't need to create wars. We have to have peace. Let's make it a global force to help other countries that are in security problems, to terrorism or uprisings and, you know, illegal stuff. But send the fax to Moscow. And I tell you, the room was so quiet, you could hear a pin fall to the floor. I was ousted. I was persona non grata. I was never invited again to the House of Lords by this person, by others, yes. I also had lunch with George Galloway, not at the House of Lords, at the canteen. George Galloway, for instance, if you know him, he's a fantastic guy with his mode show, and he's a real fighter for democracy. But to go back to this NATO problem, you know, the NATO expansion is not in Switzerland's interest as well. No. It's not at all in our interest. No. We should, we should remain humble, small, self-confident, and we should be an open door for all parties who have a problem with each other. And we can solve this process. We could call for a peace conference. We would have the clout, we would have the heritage and the power, also the financial power, to act like this. But it's not, the Swiss way is not posturing, making photo ops with a warring party or with a NATO general or, you know, on the big stage. The big stage is not for the Swiss. It's not our territory, except when it comes to peace, we have a very big stage, and that should be used by all warring parties to create peace.
I'm thinking about this, and you're absolutely right. I'm just thinking about how things have changed over the course of the last few months since this has started. Look who's been trying to negotiate the peace here and there, fits and starts, between Russia and Ukraine. And it's President Erdogan of Turkey, not yes. So that's this is a man who has zero credibility as a neutral party in anything. If anything, well, I mean, maybe he's neutral. He attacks everybody.
But it's including interesting,
his own NATO,
it's
NATO
interesting
party.
You say that. You know, we had these Minsk agreements, as you know, they are not valid anymore. No. The Minsk agreements actually are a very good framework. Why? Yeah, because Russia and Ukraine signed them already once.
Well,
the problem was, I
want to stop you. Remember, the Russians did not sign, are not signatories to the Minsk agreements. This is the sticking point, that the Donbass republics are the signatories. Yes. The four signatories are it gets repeated lazily through them because
right.
The Russians clearly made this point. Well, they're an important party to the Minsk agreements. In their potential enforcement, they are not signatories.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
No, you're right. Sorry, I slipped up.
No worries.
The point is the supervision of it, the enforcement was given to Germany and France.
Exactly.
But both are NATO partners. Mm-hmm. It's like giving this job to a bank robber to guard the bank. It doesn't really work. They have interests.
Right. Yes.
It should have been Switzerland doing it.
I agree. Agreed. It should have been Switzerland. Well, the thing is I think that the Minsk agreements, the moment they were signed, I remember discussing this with people about this. We looked at the Minsk agreements, and as a framework, they're fine, but they were designed from the ground up for both sides to reject certain parts as red lines that they would not cross. And therefore, it was always, and Merkel even came out and said this a few months ago, former Chancellor Angela Merkel, said this. They were just a delaying tactic until NATO could get, you know, until we could prep Ukraine for the war.
Well, and Poroshenko said that publicly a month or two ago.
Yeah,
he said they were the Ukrainians used them to strengthen their military against Russia with NATO. Mm-hmm. And, he said it already.
Yeah. And so and Putin's made that same statement. And whenever, you know, doesn't matter what Putin says, even if it's true, we're just going to discount it. But, you know, when one of our guys says it, or Poroshenko is definitely one of quote unquote our guys. It's sad. And
very sad.
And to watch this play out, because, you know, this could have been avoided. I've been watching this geopolitical, you know, blackhead, you know, fester and then eventually explode into this war between Russia and Ukraine for 10 years now. And it's very clear to me that going all the way back to even like 2007, 2008, when Putin made the speech at the Munich Security Conference, the Chinese and the Russians have both been saying to the West, look, let's negotiate a settlement of the way the world is going to lay out. Let's negotiate a settlement here. We don't, you know, both sides can win if we negotiate a big grand settlement. You have your areas of interest. We have ours. You can have your central banks. We can have our central banks. We can have this. We can lay the world out, but it's not going to be on your unipolar or unilateral terms.
Exactly.
And if you continue to fight us on this, you're going to drive us together and we're going to beat you in the long run, because we know how to beat you, because it's all down to the money. Russia controls the commodities. The Chinese have the labor and the manufacturing now, and you have financialization, and financialization can collapse easily.
Oh yes, absolutely. And absolutely. So it's collapsing. And you see the way I see it, why do we have now this totalitarian approach from the West since 6 months, since the war broke out on the 24th of February, which is also the birthday of my mom. This special military operation started in Ukraine.
Yep.
From that point on, in my view, America lost the hegemony. Why? Because Putin, the Russians, right or wrong, let's not argue about that, but right, the Russians stood up against the West.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you know, the Russians and the Chinese are pushing the multipolar world, which is much better, and it's based on international law.
Mm-hmm.
The Western model is a unipolar world based, they call it rules-based order.
Mm-hmm.
But who's making the rules? I don't like that. I would like to have an international law where the complaint in South Korea, in Idaho, in Switzerland, in London, in France can go to the court and refer to the international law, and the judges refer to it to make a decision.
Sure.
That's the preferred model, and that's pushed now by Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
The other opposing streak is this Western model of totalitarianism is coming also from Europe, taking liberties away from people, making the middle class poor.
Yes.
The aim is to make the middle class poorer so they don't object to things. You see, if you're an entrepreneur yourself, you have a garage or you have a barbershop or you have a small factory, you can tell the politicians off. You can tell them, hey, I'm paying taxes. I'm an employer here. What the hell are you doing? I oppose.
Right. Yes.
But if you're an employee of Johnson & Johnson, an employee of a big bank like UBS,
right,
you go 9 to 5, you do your job, you don't stick out your head. Otherwise, you're gone and replaced the next day.
Yep.
So job security has worsened a lot, and people are afraid to lose their jobs. Look at the journalists, for instance.
Yep.
I've been writing to journalists even this morning all day long. Even to Tibet, I wrote today. They are all scared to publish.
Yeah.
They are scared to publish because they are confused what's going on. The last 6 months, a lot has changed on our planet. And I tell you, I don't know anymore if the world is upside down or not.
I'm not sure if we've turned on our axis, we've gone orthogonal, we've gone plaid. I'm not even sure what metaphor to use at this point. But yes, we have entered a crisis period that is sadly, it's going to resolve itself in ugly ways. And it's either going to be war and poverty or just poverty. And usually poverty then begets war because someone has to be blamed. And you know, when I look at the landscape and I look at how broke the European Union is, and I look at how broke, truly how broke the European banking system is, and I think about the people who have been the colonizers, and I like your perspective on this, because this has been where I've, you know, kind of evolved my perspective on the way Europe is acting, is that we have an old, we have historically old colonizers going back 500-600 years who have, you know, in their minds ruled the world, or at least been able to carve up the world. And their power at this point is now a financialized power. It exists as a function of their ability to lever up dollars in the shadow banking system of Europe.
Yeah.
And if the United States, and as long as the United States has been a willing partner in this at the Federal Reserve level and at the congressional level, then this could continue. But what happens when the Federal Reserve and the commercial banks decide that they don't, in New York, no longer want to do that, no one to be a part of that system, because that system implies that they're going to die. They have to be killed off. Yeah. They're not going to go along with this. So now that's where I see we are today, that the possibility here is, and this is why things have gotten so crazy, is that we're looking at the potential for the old oligarchic order of Europe to become bankrupt and go away.
Yeah.
If the U.S. stands up and says, you know what, we're finally independent. Like, we finally finished the American independence movement 250 years after it started.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm correct on that, but this
is one of correct. The you see, the European banks and the Swiss banks are still full of problems from the last financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The banks are not cleaned out. They have been pumped up by central banks.
Yep.
And, you know, every time there's a problem, the politicians, they put the printers on to avoid unrest. That's the truth.
Yes.
With COVID, it's the same thing. They were helicoptering money to people just to keep them calm.
Mm-hmm.
They invented some kind of what they call it vaccine and forced everybody to take it. And now we find out that it's not efficient at all, that it does not prevent you from getting the virus. You know, it is absolutely mind-boggling what's going on here, also in Switzerland with the banks, because we have the second largest bank, Credit Suisse, is very close to bankruptcy now. This is the second largest bank of Switzerland. Imagine.
Right.
The share price is worth less than a coffee on Bahnhofstrasse.
Right.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It used to be at $20. Now it's at $4.50 or $5.
Jesus. Yeah, well, we're seeing the same thing, you know, and it's interesting, though, that I've been following some of this, you know, nominally. I said, take a look at like XLF, the ETF of the American banks versus the European banks, and you'll see that XLF is outperforming the European banks. And the ECB has done, you know, has tried to prop up that system for as long as they can and hope that they could get control of the Federal Reserve again. This is why there was such a massive move against Jerome Powell last year in the Federal Reserve Board, right? The insider trading scandal and things along those lines. So, why the Biden administration played politics with trying to get Powell reinstated. Like that went on for 6 months, right? And I'm sure you followed that.
I followed that. I also follow, by the way, the midterms. What is your view on the midterm elections, if I can ask you a question?
Oh, sure. I think the midterm elections are going to be the biggest tell for me at this point that the Democrats are in the kind of trouble that I've been thinking they've been in, which is an anywhere from 50 to 70 seats they're going to lose in the House and possibly 3 to 5 in the Senate, is that Nancy Pelosi is now talking about wanting to be the ambassador to Italy after the midterms. Because she doesn't want to even be, you know, in Congress anymore after the GOP takes over. So Pelosi has pulled the ripcord. If she's not standing up and, you know, on the front lines and saying we can still win this. If she's pulling the ripcord 60 days out from the election, or 55 days out from the election, like, it's over.
But here's the problem for the war. That's my thought process.
Yes.
Whenever another party comes into the House or takes the Senate, what do they do first? They denigrate the former party. Mm-hmm. They say you've done this wrong, you have done yep. this wrong, and we're doing this better. We will know how to deal with this person better.
Yep.
Republicans will probably say, you know what, Biden, you are all you Democrats, you were far too weak with the Russians. We will show you now how to deal with the Russians.
This is my worry. Yeah. And the big question is going to be, how many Trump-style populists win and how big their caucus is in Congress?
Yeah.
The Senate is still a cesspit. The GOP is absolutely, you know, there is Davos in my mind. I call these people Davos, right? Because they meet every year at Davos and they decide how they're going to carve up the world. So Klaus Schwab, Soros, the Clintons, you know, these people, they're all kind of, you know, old European money is what I call Davos. And I hate to use that because I really respect Switzerland, but unfortunately they meet
You have to know one thing since we talk about Davos. My father was the co-founder of this bullshit. my late father. My father was the chairman, but at that time it was called the Davos Symposium. It was a good thing.
It was in the late
70s. My father was the chairman of developing countries.
Right.
It was held in a small hotel. There were about 30, 40 people. At that time, with Klaus Schwab, of course, genuinely helping the developing world. Genuinely. Right. Later, my father stepped away. He had an argument with Klaus Schwab, and he told him to go fly his kite. And Schwab transgressed morphed this thing into the World Economic Forum. And that's where we are today, in a total mess because of those people.
That's absolutely fascinating, and it confirms everything I thought about all of this. Thank you so much for that. So when I think about going back to American politics, I think about the GOP, the GOP establishment, or what I call the GOPE, because there's the GOP, and then there's the establishment who runs the party. There's the Mitch McConnells and the Mitt Romneys and formerly the John McCains and formerly the Liz Cheneys. They are Davos through and through. They're globalists through and through. They're neoliberals or neoconservatives, two sides of the same coin. And they're desperate to try and maintain some kind of control. You can see it from McConnell. He's like, oh, there's too many populists are going to win. And like, yeah, Mitch. So, you know, you go back to selling cocaine, dude, because we don't need you anymore. I wish, but we'll see what happens. What I think right now is that the midterms will be the first big step. When you have a Federal Reserve chairman, Jerome Powell, come out yesterday at the Cato Institute, which is still not really libertarian, but is as libertarian as the Beltway gets, says Congress needs to get their fiscal house in order. 55 days out from a major election. The Fed chairman is not supposed to say that. That's a major, major statement of him putting his political, you know, gonads on the table. So, yeah.
How do you see interest rates progressing? How's inflation? Has it peaked in your view?
I don't think it's going to. I think we're going to have a replay of the 70s. I don't think Powell's raising interest rates to tame inflation. I think Powell's raising interest rates to break the ECB. To break the Eurodollar futures market, and to restore confidence. He's in the Volcker mode, which is that he has to figure out how to restore international capital's confidence in the Federal Reserve. And you do that by raising interest rates and draining the world of unnecessary dollars. But inflation, because it's of a cost push variety, it's a supply problem, not a demand problem. It's a labor shortage problem. It's an investment. It's a savings problem. He can't fix that yet. Yeah. That's just going to work itself out. I think the type of inflation now that's an independent process. The same thing with Volcker. What he's talking about now is inflation expectations, which in my mind is Fed speak for you guys have lost confidence in us. And so we're now going to get your expectations of inflation down so that you'll be willing to start saving, to start investing, to start rebuilding and start rejiggering capital. And reinvesting capital in out of things that are unsustainable and into things that are sustainable. So that's I actually, you know, every 40 years or so, Fed chairmen become rampant Austrians. And then they become Keynesians again after they fix everything.
Yes. Do you believe that we're going to have a hiking period going well into 23?
Oh, in terms of inflation? Yeah. I think the Fed's going to go to 6%.
Yeah, that's about what I think too.
Okay, cool. Excellent. It's nice to meet somebody who actually thinks that, because everybody else I talk to is like, oh my God, the Fed can't go to 3.5. I'm like, oh,
no, they can do it. And you know, let's give credit to Volcker. Volcker mm-hmm. has done it. I mean, he was much more extreme at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had to be. I mean, the U.S. government was issuing, just to bring this full circle, was issuing debt in Swiss francs at the time.
Yes, I know. We financed the IMF and the World Bank from Zurich here, and GE Capital, I remember, in Swiss francs in the 90s, right. Early 90s.
So Pascal, this has been a wonderful conversation. And
yeah.
And I'd love to do it again sometime. And sure. even if just informally. So
just back to the neutrality to close off.
Absolutely.
Just to remind everybody why we started talking. And, you know, it's in my interest here to bring the message home to the world. Switzerland is a very. It's a small country. It's a rich country. It's in the middle of Europe. We're surrounded by the European Union. We have survived many wars. We have this neutrality since 1815, and we cannot give up neutrality. Our president has to go back to resume neutrality. We have to abandon the sanctions regime against Russia. We have to not take sides, and for God's sakes, we have to not align with NATO.
Agreed.
It's our job to remain credible, and this is what we have to do. And I thank you for your time. For your broadcast, that I could voice my opinion here.
No, I think that the credibility issue of Switzerland is dovetails nicely with the argument at this point that everybody else's government is losing credibility. All of the That's institutions right. are failing. And so That's someone right. has to step up and be credible. And That's part right. of the thing I've seen from Americans here in the, as they're looking at Putin and they're saying, like him or not, he's credible.
He's
for
smart.
His own country, he's credible for his own country, and yeah. because and the same thing with Viktor Orban, and it's interesting. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the Italian elections in 2 weeks or the Swedish elections this weekend, but they're all part of this whole thing. But just go from there. So Pascal, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
All right, you take care.
Take care. Yeah. Have a great day.
Well, that'll about wrap it up for episode 117 of the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. You know, it's funny, while doing this, every once in a while you book a guest and you're not really quite sure how it's going to go because you've never really met the person before. And then it's fantastic. I don't know about you guys, but I really enjoyed that conversation with Pascal. And I hope to have him back on the show again at some point in the future. I think the insights into Swiss history and European history, I think, was incredibly valuable. So I know I learned a lot, and that's really ultimately as much of part of this as anything else. So you guys be well. We'll be back eventually with something else. I'm trying to book some other guests. We'll see what happens. And we'll talk soon. Keep your stick on the ice.